December 14, 2020. 1. Holly expected another night of tossing and turning, but she sleeps right through until her phone alarm, Orinoco Flow, gently wakes her. She feels rested, fully herself again. She slips to her knees, does her few morning meditations, then settles into her tiny breakfast nook for a bowl of oatmeal, a cup of yogurt, and a big mug of Constant Comment. As she enjoys her little repast, she reads the local paper on her iPad. News of the McCready school bombing has slipped from the front page, dominated as usual by the president's idiotic shenanigans, to the national news section. This is because there have been no fresh developments. More victims have been released from the hospital. 2 kids, one of them a talented basketball player, remain in critical condition. The police claim to be following a number of leads. Holly doubts it. There is nothing about Chet Ondowski, and he's the first person she thought of when Enya's high notes urged her back to wakefulness. Not her mother, not her uncle. Was she dreaming about Ondowski? If she was, she can't remember. She exits the newspaper, opens Safari, and types in Ondowski's name. The first thing she learns is that his real first name is Charles, not Chester, and he's been with Pittsburgh's NBC affiliate for the last 2 years. His stated beat is charmingly alliterative: crime, community, and consumer fraud. There are any number of videos. Holly clicks on the most recent, titled WPEN Welcomes Chet and Fred Home. Ondowski enters the newsroom, wearing a new suit, followed by a young man wearing a plaid shirt and khaki pants with big pockets on the sides. They are greeted by a wave of applause from the station staff, both the on-air people and the studio crew. Looks like 40 or 50 in all. The young man, Fred, grins. Ondowski reacts with surprise, then pleasure of an appropriately modest sort. He even applauds them in return. A woman, dressed to the nines, probably a news anchor, comes forward. "Chet, you're our hero," she says, and kisses him on the cheek. "You too, Freddy." No kiss for the young man, though, just a quick pat on the shoulder. "I'll rescue you anytime, Peggy," Ondowski says, drawing laughter and more applause. That's where the clip ends. Holly watches some more clips, choosing at random. In one, Chet stands outside a burning apartment building. In another, he's at the site of a multiple-vehicle pileup on a bridge. In the third, he's reporting on the groundbreaking of a new YMCA, complete with ceremonial silver spade and a soundtrack featuring the Village People. A fourth, from just before Thanksgiving, shows him knocking repeatedly on the door of a so-called pain clinic in Sewickley and getting nothing for his pains but a muffled, "No questions, go away." Busy guy, Holly thinks, and in none of these clips does Charles Chet Ondowski have a mole. Because it's always covered with makeup, she tells herself as she rinses her few dishes in the sink. It was just that once, when he had to get on the air in a hurry, that it showed. And why are you worrying about this anyway? It's like when some annoying pop song turns into an earworm. Because she's up early, she has time for an episode of The Good Place before leaving for work. She goes into her television room, picks up the remote, then just holds it, staring at the blank screen. After a bit, she puts the remote down and goes back into the kitchen. She powers up her iPad and finds the clip of Chet Ondowski doing his investigative song and dance about the Sewickley Pain Clinic. After the guy inside tells Chet to get lost, the story goes to Ondowski in a medium close-up, holding the mic, WPEN logo prominently displayed, to his mouth and smiling grimly. "You heard it. Self-identified pain doctor, Stefan Muller, refusing to answer questions and telling us to go away. We did, but we'll keep coming back and asking questions until we get some answers. This is Chet Ondowski in Sewickley. Back to you, David." Holly watches it again. On this run-through, she freezes the picture just as Andowski is saying, "We'll keep coming back." The mic dips a bit at that point, giving her a good view of his mouth. She spreads her fingers to zoom the image until his mouth fills the screen. There is no mole there. She's sure of it. She'd see its ghost even if it was covered with foundation and powder. Thoughts of the good place have left her mind. Andowski's initial report from the scene of the explosion isn't on the WPEN site, but it's on the NBC News site. She goes to it and once more spreads her fingers, enlarging the image until the screen is filled with Chet Andowski's mouth. And guess what? That isn't a mole at all. Is it dirt? She doesn't think so. She thinks it's hair. A spot he missed shaving, maybe. Or maybe something else. Maybe the remains of a fake mustache. Now, thoughts of getting into the office early so she can check the answering machine and do some peaceful paperwork before Pete comes in have also left her mind. She gets up and walks twice around the kitchen, her heart beating hard in her chest. What she's thinking can't be true. It's totally stupid. But what if it is true? She Googles MacCready Middle School explosion and finds the still of the delivery guy bomber. She uses her fingers to enlarge the picture, focusing on the guy's mustache. She's thinking about those cases you read about from time to time where some serial arsonist turns out to be a fireman, either from the responding department or from a volunteer crew. There was even a true crime book about that, Fire Lover, by Joseph Wambaugh. She read it when she was in high school. It's like some fracked-up Munchausen by proxy. Too monstrous. Can't be. But Holly finds herself wondering, for the first time, how Chet Andowski got to the scene of the explosion so fast, beating all the other reporters by, well, she doesn't know just how long, but he was there first. She knows that. But wait, does she? She didn't see any other reporters doing stand-ups during that first bulletin, but can she be sure? She rummages in her bag and finds her phone. Since the case she and Ralph Anderson shared, the one that ended in gunfire at the Marysville Hole, she and Ralph often talk, and it's usually early in the morning. Sometimes he calls her, sometimes she's the one who reaches out. Her finger hovers over his number, but doesn't descend. Ralph is on an unexpected and well-deserved vacation with his wife and son, and even if he's not still sleeping at 7 in the morning, it's his family time. Bonus family time. Does she want to bother him with this on so little? Maybe she can use her computer and figure it out for herself, set her mind at rest. She learned from the best, after all. Holly goes to her desktop, calls up the picture of the delivery guy bomber, and prints it out. Then she selects several headshots of Chet Andowski. He's a news guy, so there are plenty, and prints them as well. She takes all of them out to the kitchen, where the morning light is strongest. She arranges them in a square, the bomber's picture in the middle, the Andowski shots all around it. She studies them carefully for a full minute. Then she closes her eyes, counts to 30, and studies them again. She lets out a sigh that's a little disappointed and exasperated, but mostly relieved. She remembers a conversation she had with Bill once, a month or two before the pancreatic cancer finished her ex-cop partner off. She asked if he read detective novels, and Bill said only Michael Connelly's Harry Bosch stories and the 87th Precinct novels by Ed McBain. He said those books were based on actual police work. Most of the others were Agatha Christie bullshit. He told her one thing about the 87th Precinct books that had stuck with her. McBain said there are only two types of human faces, pig faces and fox faces. I'd add that sometimes you see a man or woman with a horse face, but they're rare. Mostly, It's pigs and foxes. Holly finds this a useful yardstick as she studies the headshots on her kitchen table. Both men are okay looking, wouldn't crack a mirror, her mother might have said, but in different ways. The delivery guy bomber, Holly decides to call him George just for the sake of convenience, has a fox face, rather narrow, the lips thin, the chin small and tight. The narrowness of the face is accentuated by the way George's black hair starts high on the temples and how it's short and combed tight to the skull. Ondowski, on the other hand, has a pig face. Not in any gross way, but it's round rather than narrow. His hair is light brown, his nose is broader, his lips fuller. Chet Ondowski's eyes are round, and if he's wearing corrective lenses, they are contacts. George's eyes, what she can see of them behind his glasses, look like they might be tilted at the corners. The skin tones are different, too. Ondowski is your textbook white guy, with ancestors probably hailing from Poland or Hungary or someplace like that. George the bomber has a slight olive blush to his skin. To top it off, Ondowski has a cleft chin, like Kirk Douglas. George does not. They probably aren't even the same height, Holly thinks, although, of course, it's impossible to tell for sure. Nevertheless, she grabs a magic marker from the mug on the kitchen counter and doodles a mustache on one of the Ondowski headshots. She puts this one next to the security camera still of George. It doesn't change anything. These two can't possibly be the same guy. Still, as long as she's here. She returns again to her office computer, still in her pajamas, and begins searching for other early coverage that would have been fed from the affiliates to the networks, ABC, Fox, CBS. In two of them, she can see the WPEN news van in the background. In the third, she sees Ondowski's cameraman winding up electrical cable getting ready to move to a new location. His head is bent, but Holly recognizes him anyway by the baggy khakis with the side pockets. It's Fred from the Welcome Home video. Ondowski isn't in that one, so he's probably already helping in the rescue efforts. She goes back to Google and finds another station, an independent that was probably on the scene. She plugs WPIT Breaking News McCready School into her search engine and finds a video of a young woman who looks barely old enough to be out of high school. She's doing her stand-up beside the giant metal pine cone with its blinking Christmas lights. Her station's news van is there, parked in the turnout behind a Subaru sedan. The young reporter is clearly horrified, stumbling over her words, doing a clumsy job of reporting that will never get her hired or even noticed by one of the bigger stations. Holly doesn't care. When the young woman's cameraman zooms in on the school's broken outside, focusing on EMTs, police, and plain old civilians digging in the wreckage and carrying stretchers, she gleeps, Bill's word, Chet Ondowski. He's digging like a dog, bent over and tossing bricks and broken boards between his spread legs. He came by those cuts on his hands, honestly. He was there first, Holly says. Maybe not before the first responders, but before any of the other TV. Her phone rings. It's still in the bedroom, so she answers on her desktop, a little Philip Jerome added on one of his visits.
Are you on your way? Pete asks.
To where?
Holly is honestly bewildered. She feels like she's been yanked out of a dream.
Toomey Ford, he says. Did you really forget? That's not like you, Holly.
It's not, but she has. Tom Toomey, who owns the dealership, is pretty sure one of his salesmen, Dick Ellis, a star performer, has been underreporting his accounts, possibly to provide for a little dolly he's seeing on the side, possibly to support a drug habit.
He sniffs a lot, Toomey said. Claims it's the air conditioning. In December, give me a break.
This is Ellis's day off, which means it's a perfect opportunity for Holly to run some numbers, do some comparisons, and see if something's wrong. She could make an excuse to Pete, but the excuse would be a lie, and she doesn't do that, unless she absolutely has to anyway. I did forget. I'm sorry.
Want me to go out there?
No. If the numbers support Toomey's suspicions, Pete will have to go out later and confront Ellis. Being ex-police himself, he's good at that. Holly, not so much. Tell Mr. Toomey I'll meet him for lunch, wherever he wants, and Finders will pick up the tab.
Okay, but he'll pick someplace expensive.
A pause.
Holly, are you chasing something?
Is she? And why did she think of Ralph Anderson so quickly? Is there something she's not telling herself?
Holly, still there?
Yes, she says. I'm here. I just overslept. So, lying after all.
2. Holly takes a quick shower, then dresses in one of her fade-into-the-woodwork business suits. Chet Ondowski stays on her mind all the while. It occurs to her that she might know a way to answer the major question that's nagging at her, so she goes back to her computer and opens Facebook. No sign that Chet Ondowski does that one, or Instagram either. Unusual for a TV personality, they usually love social media. Holly tries Twitter, and bingo, there he is. Chet Ondowski, at COndowski1. The school explosion happened at 2:19. Ondowski's first tweet from the scene came over an hour later, and this doesn't surprise Holly. Busy, busy, busy was COndowski1. The tweet reads, "McCready School. Horrible tragedy. 15 dead so far, maybe many more. Pray, Pittsburgh, pray." It's heart-rending, but Holly's heart isn't rent. She's gotten very tired of all the thoughts and prayers bullpoop, maybe because it seems too pat somehow, probably because she's not interested in Ondowski's aftermath tweets. They are not what she's looking for. She becomes a time traveler, scrolling back along Ondowski's feed to before the explosion happened, and at 1:46 p.m., she finds a photograph of a retro diner with a parking lot in the foreground. The neon sign in the window says, "We've got home cooking, good looking." Ondowski's tweet is below the picture.
"Just time for coffee and pie at Clausen's before off to Eden. See my report on the world's largest garage sale on PEN tonight at 6.
Holly Googles Clausen's diner and finds it in Pierre Village, Pennsylvania. A further check on Google, what did we ever do without it, she wonders, shows her that Pierre Village is less than 15 miles from Pineboro and the McCready School, which explains how he and his cameraman got there first. He was on his way to cover the world's largest garage sale in a town called Eden. A further check shows her that Eden Township is 10 miles north of Pierre Village and about the same distance from Pineboro. He just happened to be in the right place, near it anyway, at the right time. Besides, she's pretty sure the local police, or maybe the investigators from ATF, have already asked both Ondowski and Fred the cameraman about their fortuitous arrival, not because either is an actual suspect, but because the authorities will be crossing every T and dotting every I in a bombing situation where there have been multiple fatalities and casualties. Her phone is now in her handbag. She takes it out, calls Tom Toomey, and asks if it's too late for her to come by the dealership and look at some figures, maybe have a peek at the suspected salesman's computer.
"Absolutely," Toomey tells her. "But I had my face fixed for lunch at DiMaggio's. Their fettuccine Alfredo is amazing. Is that still part of the deal?"
"Absolutely," Holly says, inwardly wincing as she thinks of the expense slip she will be filling out later. "DiMaggio's isn't cheap." As she goes out, she tells herself to think of it as penance for lying to Pete. Lies are a slippery slope, each one usually leading to two more.
3.
Tom Toomey devours his fettuccine Alfredo with a napkin tucked into the collar of his shirt, eating and slurping with abandon, and follows it up with a mixed nut panna cotta.
Holly has an antipasto and refuses dessert, settling for a cup of decaf. She eschews caffeine after 8 a.m.
You really should have dessert, Toomey says. It's a celebration. Looks like you saved me a bundle.
We did, Holly says. The firm. Pete will get Ellis to own up, and there'll be at least some restitution. That should draw a line under it.
There you go. So come on, he coaxes.
Selling seems to be his default position.
Have something sweet. Treat yourself.
As if she's the one who just got the scoop on a cheating employee. Holly shakes her head and tells him she's full. The fact is, she wasn't hungry when she sat down, although her oatmeal was hours ago. Her mind keeps returning to Chet Ondowski, her earworm.
Watching your figure, I guess, huh?
Yes, Holly says, which isn't quite a lie. She watches her calorie intake, and her figure takes care of itself. Not that she has anyone to watch it for. Mr. Toomey should be watching his own figure. He's digging his grave with his fork and spoon, but it isn't her place to tell him that. You should bring in your lawyer and a forensic accountant if you plan to prosecute Mr. Ellis, she says. My figures won't be enough in court.
You betcha. Toomey concentrates on his panna cotta, demolishing what's left, then looks up. I don't get it, Holly. I thought you'd be more pleased. You nailed a bad guy.
How bad the salesman is or isn't would depend on why he's been chipping away money on the side, but that isn't Holly's business. She only gives Toomey what Bill used to call her Mona Lisa smile.
Something else on your mind? Toomey asks. Another case?
Not at all, Holly replies, which is also not a lie. Not really. The MacCready School explosion is also none of her business. She has no skin in the game, Jerome would say. But that mole that wasn't a mole stays on her mind. Everything about Chet Ondowski seems legit, except for the thing that got her wondering about him in the first place. There is a reasonable explanation, she thinks, as she motions for the waiter to bring the check. You're just not seeing it. Let it go. Just let it go. 4. The office is empty when she gets back. Pete has left a note on her computer that says, Ratner spotted in a bar down by the lake. On my way. Call me if you need me. Herbert Ratner is a bail jumper with a long history of not appearing when his cases, there have been many, are called in court. Holly mentally wishes Pete luck and goes to the files, which she and Jerome, when he gets a chance, have been digitizing. It will keep her mind off on Dowski, she thinks, but it doesn't. After just 15 minutes, she gives up and goes to Twitter. Curiosity killed the cat, she thinks, but satisfaction brought him back. I'll just check this one thing, then return to the scut work. She finds on Dowski's diner tweet. Before, she was concentrating on the words. Now it's the photograph that she studies. Silver retro diner. Cute neon sign in the window. Parking in front. The lot is only half full, and nowhere does she see the WPEN news van. They might have parked around back, she says. Maybe true. She has no way of knowing if there are more spaces behind the diner. But why do that when there were so many available spaces in front, just a few steps from the door? She starts to exit the tweet, then stops and bends forward until her nose is almost touching the screen. Her eyes are wide. She feels the sense of satisfaction she gets when she finally thinks of the word that's been giving her fits in a crossword, or when she finally sees where a troublesome piece goes into a jigsaw puzzle. She highlights Ondowski's diner photo and slides it to one side. Then she finds the video of the inept young reporter doing her stand-up beside the giant pine cone. The Indy Station's van, older and humbler than those of the network affiliates, is parked in the turnout behind a forest green Subaru sedan, which means the Subaru was almost certainly there first, or the positions would be reversed. Holly freezes the video and pulls the diner photo as close as she can, and yes, there's a forest green Subaru sedan in the diner parking lot. It's not conclusive. There are plenty of Subarus on the road, but Holly knows what she knows. It's the same one. It's Ondowski's. He parked in the turnout and then hustled to the scene. She's so deep in the center of her head that when her phone rings, she gives a little scream. It's Jerome. He wants to know if she has any lost dogs for him or lost kids. He says he feels ready to move up to the next rung on the ladder. No, she says, but you could... She stops short of asking him if he can track down any information about a WPEN cameraman named Fred, perhaps by posing as a blogger or a magazine writer. She should be able to track down Fred herself, using her trusty computer. And there's something else. She doesn't want Jerome involved in this. She won't let herself think exactly why, but the feeling is strong.
Could what? He asks.
I was going to say that if you wanted to go bar hopping down by the lake, you could look for...
Love bar hopping, Jerome says. Love it.
I'm sure you do, but you'd be looking for Pete, not drinking beer. See if he needs any help with a bail jumper named Herbert Ratner. Ratner's white, about 50.
Neck tattoo of a hawk or something, Jerome says. Saw the photo on the bulletin board, Holly Berry.
He's a non-violent offender, but be careful just the same. If you see him, don't approach him without Pete.
Got it, got it. Jerome sounds excited, his first real crook.
Be careful, Jerome. She can't help reiterating this. If anything happened to Jerome, it would wreck her. And please don't call me Holly Berry. It's worn very thin. He promises, but she doubts if he means it. Holly returns her attention to her computer, eyes ticking back and forth between the two forest green Subarus. It means nothing, she tells herself. You're only thinking what you're thinking because of what happened in Texas. Bill would call it Blue Ford Syndrome. If you bought a Blue Ford, he said, you suddenly saw Blue Fords everywhere. But this wasn't a Blue Ford. It was a green Subaru, and she can't help what she is thinking. There is no John Law for Holly that afternoon. By the time she leaves the office, she has more information, and she's troubled. 5. At home, Holly makes herself a little meal and 15 minutes later has forgotten what it was. She calls her mother to ask if she's been to see Uncle Henry. Yes, Charlotte says. Holly asks how he's doing. He's confused, Charlotte says, but he seems to be adjusting. Holly has no idea if this is true, because her mother has a way of jiggering her view of the world until she's seeing it the way she wants to see it. He'd like to see you, Charlotte says, and Holly promises she'll go as soon as she can, maybe this weekend, knowing he'll call her Janie, because Janie is the one he wants, the one he loves best, and always will, even though Janie has been dead for 6 years. This isn't self-pity. Just the truth. You have to accept the truth. Have to accept the truth, she says. Have to, like it or not. With this in mind, she picks up her phone, almost calls Ralph, and again keeps herself from doing it. Why spoil his time off just because the two of them bought a Blue Ford down in Texas and now she's seeing them everywhere? Then she realizes she doesn't have to talk to him. At least not in person. She gets her phone and a bottle of ginger ale and goes into the TV room. Here, the walls are lined with books on one side and DVDs on the other, everything arranged in alphabetical order. She sits in her comfortable viewing chair, but instead of powering up the big screen Samsung, she opens her phone's recording app. She just looks at it for a few moments, then pushes the big red button. Hello, Ralph. It's me. I'm recording this on December 14th. I don't know if you'll ever hear it, because if what I'm thinking turns out to be nothing, and it probably will, I'll just delete it. But saying it out loud might, clarify my thoughts. She pauses the recording, thinking about how she should start. I know you remember what happened in that cave when we finally met the outsider, face to face. He wasn't used to being found out, was he? He asked what made me able to believe. It was Brady that made me able to do that. Brady Hartsfield. But the outsider didn't know about Brady. He asked if it was because I'd seen another like him somewhere. Do you remember how he looked and sounded when he asked that? I do. Not just eager. Greedy. He thought he was the only one. I thought so, too. I think we both did. But, Ralph, I'm starting to wonder if there might be another one, after all. Not quite the same, but similar. The way dogs and wolves are similar, say. It might only be what my old friend Bill Hodges used to call Blue Ford Syndrome. But if I'm right, I need to do something about it. Don't I? The question sounds plaintive, lost. She pauses the recording again, thinking about deleting that last, and decides not to. Plaintive and lost is exactly how she feels right now, and besides, Ralph will probably never hear this. She goes again. Our outsider needed time to transform. There was a period of hibernation, weeks or months, while he changed from looking like one person to looking like another. He wore a chain of faces going back years, maybe even centuries. This guy, though, if what I'm thinking is true, he can change much faster, and I'm having trouble believing that, which is kind of ironic. Do you remember what I said to you the night before we went after our perp? That you had to set your lifelong concept of reality aside. It was okay for the others not to believe, but you had to. I said if you didn't believe, we were probably going to die, and that would allow the outsider to keep moving along, wearing the faces of other men and leaving them to take the blame when more children died. She shakes her head, even laughs a little. I was like one of those revival preachers exhorting unbelievers to come to Jesus, wasn't I? Only now, I'm the one trying not to believe. Trying to tell myself it's just paranoid Holly Gibney jumping at shadows the way I used to before Bill came along and taught me to be brave. Holly takes a deep breath. The man I'm worried about is named Charles Ondowski, although he goes by Chet. He's a TV reporter, and his beat is what he calls the three C's, crime, community, and consumer fraud. He does cover community affairs, stuff like groundbreaking ceremonies and the world's largest garage sale, and he covers consumer fraud. There's even a segment on his station's nightly news called Chet on Guard. But what he covers mostly is crime and disaster. Tragedy. Death. Pain. And if all that doesn't remind you of the outsider who killed the boy in Flint City and the two little girls in Ohio, I'd be very surprised. Shocked, in fact. She pauses the recording long enough to take a big drink of her ginger ale. Her throat is as dry as the desert, and lets out a resounding belch that makes her giggle. Feeling a little better, Holly pushes the record button and makes her report, just as she would when investigating any case. Repo, lost dog, car salesman chipping $600 here, $800 there. Doing that is good. It's like disinfecting a wound that has begun to show some minor but still troubling redness.
December 15, 2020. When she wakes up the next morning, Holly feels brand new, ready to work and also ready to put Chet Ondowski and her paranoid suspicions about him behind her. Was it Freud or Dorothy Parker who once said that sometimes a cigar is just a cigar? Whichever one it was, sometimes a dark spot beside a reporter's mouth is just hair or dirt that looks like hair. Ralph would tell her that if he ever heard her audio recording, which he almost certainly won't. But it did the job. Talking it out cleared her head. And that way, it was like her therapy sessions with Allie, because if Ondowski could somehow morph into George the Bomber, then morph back into himself again, why would he leave a little piece of George's mustache behind? The idea is ridiculous. Or take the green Subaru. Yes, it belongs to Chet Ondowski, she's sure of that. She took it for granted that he and his cameraman, Fred Finkel is his name, finding that was a snap, no Jerome necessary, were traveling together in the station's news van. But that was an assumption rather than a deduction. And Holly believes the path to hell is paved with faulty assumptions. Now that her mind is rested, she can see that Ondowski's decision to travel alone is perfectly reasonable and perfectly innocent. He's a star reporter at a big metro TV station. He's Chet on guard, for heaven's sake. And as such, he can get up a little later than the hoi polloi, maybe drop by the station and later enjoy coffee and pie at his favorite diner, while Fred, the faithful cameraman, goes to Eden to do B-roll. As a film buff, Holly knows that's what they call it. And maybe even, if Fred has aspirations of rising in the news department hierarchy, pre-interview the people Ondowski should talk to when he does his world's largest garage sale stand-up for the 6 o'clock news. Only Ondowski gets the news flash, maybe on a police scanner, about the school explosion, and beats feet to the location. Fred Finkel does the same driving the news van. Ondowski parks beside that ridiculous pine cone, and that's where he and Finkel go to work. All perfectly explicable. No supernatural elements need apply. This is just a case of a private investigator hundreds of miles away who happens to be suffering from Blue Ford syndrome. Voila! Holly has a good day at the office. Ratner, that master criminal, has been spotted by Jerome in a bar with the amazing, to Holly at least, name of the Edmund Fitzgerald Tap Room and escorted to county lockup by Pete Huntley. Pete is currently at the Toomey dealership where he will confront Richard Ellis. Barbara Robinson, Jerome's sister, drops by telling Holly, rather smugly, that she has been excused from afternoon classes because she's doing a report called Private Investigation, Fact versus Fiction. She asks Holly a few questions, recording the answers on her own phone, then helps Holly with the files. At 3 o'clock, they settle down to watch John Law. I love this guy, he's so jive, Barbara says as Judge Law boogies his way to the bench. Pete doesn't agree, Holly says. Yes, but Pete is white, Barbara says. Holly looks at Barbara, wide-eyed. I'm white, Barbara giggles. Well, there's white, and there's really white, which is what Mr. Huntley is. They laugh together, then watch as Judge Law deals with a burglar who claims he didn't do anything. He's just a victim of racial profiling. Holly and Barbara give each other one of those telepathic looks, as if. Then they burst out laughing again. A very good day, and Chet Ondowski hardly crosses Holly's mind until her phone rings at 6 o'clock that evening, just as she's settling in to watch Animal House. That call from Dr. Carl Morton changes everything. When it finishes, Holly makes one of her own. An hour later, she receives another call. She takes notes on all three. The next morning, she's on her way to Portland, Maine.